Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see $100,000,
$600,000,
yeah, you're
looking
at
deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22 million.
Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie Johnson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out to Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing, and I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking, And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he would.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarion. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarion took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarion, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back, telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
Shit, dude! Yeah. PTSD to your face, yeah, dude! Your ass. That bitch scared, nigga! Oh! Oh! Beat her motherfucking ass! She drug you, motherfucking nigga! Beat her motherfucking ass!
That nigga can't so
you
hurting himself!
You from New State!
Hey, no! It's over. What I say it's over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
Who got some money?
Because
I ain't caught it. I'll
slap
the fuck out of one
real quick.
Just like
this. He will find God. Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, Why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumb ass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police, like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavored Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old. And I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you gotta own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
By the time you met Blondone.
I made $3 million in just 6 months as a 20-year-old female entrepreneur, and you can too. Growing up, I was always in like the advanced classes. In high school, I was in the AP, the honors classes. And so even being separated from so many people, even starting at a young age, it definitely made me realize that I'm a little bit different. It was a little bit hard to fit in. I'm black, I'm Hispanic, I'm Muslim. I went through so many different phases of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I remember there was a point in time where I wanted to be an engineer. I wanted to be an interior designer. My sophomore year, I lived with my dad. That same year, my brother Jamil lived with my dad, and we were always super close. First day I got there, he took me to his room and he showed me the stack of books that he had. And one of them was called How to Win Friends and Influence People. And he's like, you gotta read this book. You gotta start reading. It's really gonna change your mindset. It's really gonna help you be successful. He had this whiteboard on his wall and it said, I will be a millionaire by 22. And in my head, like, I was thinking, like, where did he come up with that? Like, we've never seen a millionaire in our life. Money was never something that we grew up seeing. It was never something that we were familiar with. My family never had a lot of money in any aspect. I thought that it was amazing that he had such drive and could picture a goal that seemed so far off, but to him seemed achievable. Junior year, I was living by myself. I had actually moved away from my dad's, and I was living with family friends. The same year that I was living by myself, my oldest brother passed away. And when he passed away, my whole perspective on life changed. Everything, like school, the people that I hung around, what was important to me, how I was spending each day, because I really realized that life is so, so, so short. And the fact that my brother was taken at 22, I was only 16, and he was one of the closest people to me. And so I never understood why he was taken so soon. I didn't understand it. I was going through my own grieving process. It changed everything and put life into a different perspective. I really got very selective with what I was putting into my mind, the people that I was hanging around. I got very isolated. I started really just focusing on my art, on working, and really just being alone and focusing on my family. I was asking myself, I didn't see my brother before he passed away because it wasn't winter break yet, because I had to stay in school for winter break. Was school ever that important where I didn't see my brother before he passed away because I had to be at school? You could not even finish school and your life could be over. I have other things that are more important to me, my family, my time, what I want to do with my life. Because we grow up from kindergarten to 12th grade in school, we naturally rely on like who we are as a student as part of our identity. What you start to realize is like all you're doing is giving power to someone else to tell you how valuable you are or to tell you how qualified you are. I didn't need someone else to tell me if I was worth doing a job or not, or if I was good enough to do something, because if I wanted to do something, I just had to decide to do it, and I don't need validation from someone else, whether that be a teacher, whether that be a professor, whether that be an employer, from anyone. You don't actually need validation from someone. You just have to decide within yourself that you're capable of doing it and go for it. Once I got into college and I started going through the day-to-days, I was working two full-time jobs. It was exhausting. I spent a lot of time doing things for other people. It was like I was doing my schoolwork for my teachers, but it didn't really make sense to me. I wasn't really understanding what I was supposed to get out of it. I was nannying to make enough money to survive, but it wasn't enough to do anything beyond that because I had to spend all my time working. One day I was sitting in class and I was listening to my teacher talk, and he gave us this huge assignment, and it was a predominantly white school, so everyone partnered up into these groups, and I was just sitting there by myself. And again, I felt like I didn't fit in. I started like just wondering, what am I doing here? These assignments, these aren't helping me progress in the area that I want to progress in. They're kind of just like buffer time. They're just busy assignments to keep us busy. It wasn't really what I needed to achieve the success I wanted. And actually, at the same time, I was finishing up first semester of my freshman year of college. I got an interview with this very high-profile family for nannying, and I'd never had an experience like that. And even when the experience came up, I kept asking myself, like, why me? Like, why am I getting this opportunity to work for such a high-profile family? I'm an 18-year-old who's not even CPR certified. Out of all people, why would they pick me? And my mom kept telling me, like, that's not the right mentality to have. Like, who cares if you're 18 years old? You know that you're an amazing nanny. You know that you're caring, compassionate, that you know how to care for children. You've done that your whole life. And then I started asking myself, would I rather learn from a professor, or would I rather learn from a billionaire who has the lifestyle that I want and I could actually learn from him in person and see his lifestyle? So at the end of freshman year, I remember we were finishing up with classes, and I was listening to these tapes, and they said people who are successful make decisions quickly and they stick to those decisions. I decided right then and there, I was like, I'm going to be done with school. I'm going to drop out.
And so that same day I texted my counselor and I said, please unenroll me from all upcoming classes. And she was like, oh no, like, is something wrong? Is there something I can help with? And I was like, no, thank you. Just please unenroll me. I'll no longer be attending Maryville. If I'm not going to go to school, I have to figure out how I'm going to be a successful entrepreneur. I started reading books. I started watching YouTube videos. I was doing cosmetology. I learned how to do nails completely by myself. So after trying e-com, drop shipping, trading stock options, I finally started Airbnb, and Airbnb actually went amazing for me. I started off by renting. I actually didn't own any properties. I now have 11 Airbnbs that I rent. And even from that, I learned how to do rental arbitrage. And at first, I didn't really understand it fully, but I was learning as I went. I kind of went through the mistakes, the learning curve, figured out what worked and what didn't work. And then everyone started seeing, like, this 20-year-old girl is making five figures a month, making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a month from Airbnb without renting any properties. And everyone started asking me, like, can you teach me? Can you help me? Like, how are you doing it? If I can genuinely help someone else and make a difference in their life through something that I learned, then why not? Me and my partner, we decided to create a coaching business. Bryson played a huge role in helping in our success with Airbnb, even changing my mindset from when my brother first passed away. I was grieving a lot. I was really sad. When I met Bryson, he really helped me realize that you have to have a positive mindset if you want to attract positive things. Everyone started asking a ton of questions. So after we started our coaching business, we kind of just kept scaling and growing. We made up to $60,000 in a month from Airbnb. And then we started getting students who were also getting results. And so we started an entire coaching program. I was actually able to hire a lot of my family to work with me to keep scaling this coaching business so we could keep providing coaching to more and more students and give them more and more offers. We have done for you offers. We have mentorships. And that way there's something for everyone to learn and something for everyone to grow from. I remember when we first started our free class, I told my brother, I don't think you need to go to college, but that's just me. I promise you this month, I'm going to make $100,000 this month. June of 2022, I made $100,000 in a month. That was my first six-figure month. After that, I told my brother, like, I'm going to make $200,000 this month. In July, we made over $200,000. Our revenue just kept increasing as we started making more and more of an impact for more people. And in October, me and Bryson, we were like, we're going to make $1 million this month. And in October, we made $1 million. November, we made $1 million. Finishing up the end of the year, we generated over $3 million from our Airbnbs and also from our coaching. The intentional actions, the positive mindset, and actually living in what you say you're going to do, that's how we made $3 million. For most of the journey, me and Bryson, we pretty much kept everything low-key just because no one really understands it. And the way that we grew up, no one really had a lot of money. So imagine going to people who've never seen a lot of money and being like, we made $100,000 or we made $1 million at 20 years old. They're not going to understand. And there's just a lot of people who don't understand the concept of entrepreneurship. When we were finally able to start bringing our family in and bringing people in and actually changing their lives, I think it was so inspirational to them. What I realized is that making more money, you're not a different person. You're the same person, but it gives you so much more freedom and it gives you so much more opportunity. So for me, I've been able to work with my whole family and now inspire them and show them that there's so much more. And this is even them working with me now is just a stepping stone for what they can do and give them more time freedom so that they can do those things. Even being an entrepreneur and being a female or being a minority, it's definitely different. People look at you different. I walk into places, no one knows I have money, and they look at me, they kind of brush me off because they wouldn't think that I have money. Or I walk into a business setting with Bryson and they immediately talk to Bryson because they don't think that I have anything to do with the business. They just think that I'm there. But what they don't know is that I'm actually a female entrepreneur. And just because you're a woman doesn't mean that you can't be driven, that you can't be outspoken or say how you feel. If you have a dream, go after it and chase it. Don't let the people that surround you, don't let people that you grew up with, don't let your parents, don't let society tell you that it's not okay. I think a big thing is learning who to listen to. Because what I learned is that everyone has an opinion, but if they don't have what I want or they don't have the lifestyle that I want to live or hold the same values as me or the same morals as me, as much as I love them and as much as I respect them, it doesn't make sense for me to listen to them because they don't have what I want. And so what I would tell my younger self would be think bigger and learn who to listen to. And then not just that, but it's okay to be yourself. You don't have to feel scared if you don't fit in. You don't have to feel like you have to conform to society or to what people want you to be. Each day that you're intentional, little by little, even when you don't know it or when you can't see it, you're building the life that you want. You have to know what you want and be intentional behind it every day, and it'll come to you.
With nearly 30,000 cafes across the globe, Starbucks has become more than just a household name. From its iconic cups, often adorned with misspelled names, to the espresso inside them, Starbucks has catapulted from one coffee bean shop in Seattle to a sprawling $80 billion business over the last 47 years. Starbucks sales account for 57% of the total cafe market. Yes, 57%. Nearly two-thirds of all coffee sold at cafes in the U.S. comes from a Starbucks. But this impressive expansion hasn't come without growing pains. With more than 14,000 locations in the U.S. alone, Starbucks has spread itself too thin. Having too many stores has led to fewer transactions at individual stores. To compensate, the company has raised prices. But doing this too quickly or too often can drive customers away. So how did this happen? And what's a coffee giant to do about it? The year is 1970. Three college friends, Zev Siegel, Jerry Baldwin, and Gordon Boker, decide to get into the coffee business. They found a mentor in Alfred Peet, founder of Peet's Coffee, and the man responsible for bringing custom coffee roasting to the U.S.
He knew the coffee industry inside and out, especially the gourmet end. He was the most educated coffee guy in the country at that time.
So with Peet's help, the three friends opened Starbucks, a coffee bean shop and roastery at Seattle's famous Pike Place Market in 1971. Peet provided the young entrepreneurs with roasted coffee beans and connected them with coffee brokers until they could set up their own roastery and source their own beans. For the first decade, the founders opened five more locations in Seattle. At this point, contemporary coffee consumers might have noticed a glaring absence, actual coffee drinks. But that's the thing about the 70s coffee culture. It didn't really exist outside the home.
There were no coffee bars, nor was there much of a demand for espresso-based drinks. You purchased coffee beans, and you either took them home as beans, or we ground them for you in the store. Nobody expected to get a beverage at a Starbucks coffee store until after 1980.
Starbucks' initial focus was bringing high-quality beans to consumers who were more accustomed to instant or canned coffee. But that changed with the addition of one man.
The company hired its first really professional director of marketing and sales. And that man was Howard Schultz. And he couldn't figure out why we weren't selling beverages.
In 1983, Schultz travels to Italy and returns with an idea: turn the coffee bean stores into cafes. Starbucks served its first latte the next year. The experiment was a success. And 4 years later, Schultz partnered with investors and bought Starbucks for $3.8 million. He was only 34 at the time. Schultz pursued a strategy of aggressive expansion. By the time the company went public in 1992, it had 165 stores. By 1996, it had opened more than 1,000 locations, including its first international cafes in Japan and Singapore. Growth was so rapid that just 3 years later, Starbucks opened its 2,000th location.
Once they found a business model that worked, that translated to other geographies, that gave them the opportunity to really accelerate growth, really put the pedal to the metal in terms of expanding across the globe.
Schultz switched from CEO to executive chairman in 2000, at which time Starbucks operated 3,500 stores in more than a dozen countries. Between 2000 and 2007, the number of Starbucks cafes more than quadrupled, from 3,500 to over 15,000. During this period, the company opened an average of 1,500 stores every year, including 2,500 in 2007 alone. Sales shot up from $2 billion to $9.4 billion. Consumers were increasingly ditching their kitchen mugs for these iconic paper-to-go cups. But then Starbucks hit a wall. 2007 financial crash. That year, its rapid growth screeched to a halt, and its stock price plummeted by 50% as cash-strapped consumers backed away from pricey coffee habits.
The Great Recession was devastating for the restaurant industry. What we typically saw was more trading out, so consumers taking a pause on that everyday luxury that Starbucks offered.
So Starbucks brought back Howard Schultz. This news alone caused Starbucks stock to shoot up by 9%. Schultz halted growth and focused on customer experience. He shuttered cafes, more than 600 in 2008 and another 300 in 2009, and laid off around 6,700 baristas. A month after his return, Schultz ordered Starbucks to close all of its U.S. locations for one afternoon so he could retrain more than 135,000 baristas about how to make its signature espresso. Schultz's goal was to remind customers what they loved about the brand by making the stores an experience, not just a place to get a quick coffee.
Thank you. why did I play a James Bond theme? Well, that goes with the title of our live stream title today. Biscuits and coffee. Biscuits and coffee. And coffee, the primary ingredient of coffee is water. And that James Bond theme, which is the movie I'm thinking of, and probably my favorite James Bond movie of all time, The Quantum of Solace. The Quantum of Solace. If you know what that movie was about, because I would say James Bond goes green. He went green on that assignment. And if you saw that movie, 619-768-2945, that's 619-768-2945, press 1. And if you saw it, give us your thoughts on that movie. But that is, I would say that's my favorite James Bond movie. Deals with water. It deals with water. Something that a lot of us take for granted. But there's a lot of money in water. Might be an interesting business to get into. The according to my research, is Nestle's Waters. And they did over $104 billion. I don't know what date they have this year. They have this on. The bottled water industry does over $342 billion. And that's what they did in 2023. Let's see. In the United States, there's 50 billion bottles of water purchased. And you know what's interesting about water? We're living on and we're walking on an ocean of water, every last one of us. Matter of fact, you can... Jesus, I'm looking at some of these companies like billion-dollar companies, multi-billion-dollar, Dasani. They do over $3 billion. Aquafina, $872 million. Poland Springs Water, $670 million. Ozarka Water, $579 million. Fiji Water, gross annual sales, $43 million. And they're headquartered out of Los Angeles. But they're promoting Fiji. All right, anyway. Let's see, they're in 60 countries. That's Fiji Water. You know what? I would say investigate that. That's an interesting business to get into. But we're driving on it. We're driving on the ocean of water. We're walking on the ocean of water. We're living on the ocean of water, oceans of water. But a lot of us just take it for granted, and we, you know, get it. If you live in a Western country, you get it from your local municipality. Whereas, and in some places, you know, like where I'm at, I have my own well. You know, with filters in it, reverse osmosis and all, I got all, you know, but some places that you live, like in your really large cities, no, they banned that. The local municipality, they want it all for themselves. All right. But anyway, so there's a lot of money in water, flavored water in the name of coffee. And if you make a real good cup of coffee, you might, that seems like that could be, I mean, everything starts with an idea. I mean, Starbucks didn't start out the way it started off. But, you know, water. This coffee is nothing but glorified water. And then biscuits. Look at the number of businesses, high-profile businesses, that make millions of dollars on an individual basis by selling a biscuit. Now, at McDonald's, it could be, or what do you want? A bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit, or do you want a sausage biscuit? You know, that's just McDonald's. You know, so how many places sells a breakfast biscuit of some type? Something that your grandmother, your mother, or even you, I mean, it's not, hey, when you go on YouTube and get a recipe of a biscuit. But anyway, just throwing that out there. You know what? Here, let me get it before it goes. Coming up on September, which is in a few days, we're going to be doing microgreens, live streams and all that. I'm trying to get it to play right now, but
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre, and that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get...
4 years ago, we started...
Okay. All right. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole solar cabin thing, but the first thing he recommended is get you a piece of land. All right. Next month, we have two projects. You can join with us on a live stream. You can even make money with us as we do this, too. One of our projects will be to, instead of doing it, we're going to be constructing sleeping boxes. Because all a house is a collection of boxes called rooms. So we're going to get fundamental next month on that. But the other thing we're going to get fundamental on, which you can follow us on and make, we'll be doing live streams on this, video streams, where you can see the visual, or microgreens. So I got some information I want to read to you about microgreens, but listen to this audio about microgreens. This guy does $20,000 a month growing and selling microgreens. And if anything, now, I'll be participating in this because you'll see in the live streams that we'll be doing. One thing, just to lower my food bill, because I like microgreens myself. But you're not going to eat everything you grow. So if you want to use it as a side hustle, you can do that too. Anyway, this article is about a guy. He earns $20,000 a month growing microgreens. And microgreens, they can be harvested, some, not all, can be harvested from seed time to harvest anywhere from 10 days, 20 days, 30 days. Even if you stretch it out to 30 days, that's not a long time. Anyway, we'll get more into detail on that after this.
4 years ago, we started a microgreen farm. We started growing microgreens at home in our living room. And today we got to the point where we maxed out a room of 300 square meters. So today I'm going to give you a little tour of the room, and I'm also going to give you some really good tips for if you want to grow microgreens at home or you want to make it into a business, I'm going to give you those tips in the end of the video. As you can see here, we're growing a variety of different kinds of microgreens. We basically turn this into a business where we are delivering microgreens like this in trays, still alive, for over 1,000 restaurant companies and catering, cafes, everything in Denmark. So we learned a lot on this journey about how to grow the product really nice so it looks fresh and it's the shelf life is really high in this product. And basically we grew from growing in our living room to growing in a basement to growing in a 10 square meter little room to 100 square meters, and now today we are operating in our own building where we have 300 square meters. In the back we are growing mushrooms, as you saw in some of the other videos, and we really turned this into a way of living for us. We are employing around 30 people here in Denmark, with expanding into Czech Republic. Hopefully soon we're going to expand into other countries as well. So this is like a really fun business to operate because we are in the process of communicating a lot with chefs. We're communicating with other gardeners, and it's like a product that's alive, so it's really difficult to maintain the freshness if we don't sell it in the right way and if we don't sell it in the right time. If we sell it a little too late, then maybe the customers don't like that the product gets too big and the quality diminishes. So if we sell it a little too early, then the product hasn't fully grown out and some people think it's a waste of money. So we really have to maintain a quality that like looks good and fresh all the time, and basically that's one of the hardest thing about doing a microgreen business, because that's what they don't tell you. It's really difficult to sell the product if you don't know how, and it's really difficult to maintain a stable quality. So yeah, we came around all those things and it worked out really great, and now we are doing 25 different varieties of microgreens. So I'm gonna take you a little tour around the room and you can see what we are doing. So you can see here the peas, they are really nice and fresh. We are growing these in different sizes. We're growing them really tall, or we're growing them like this tiny petite peas. They are really, really great. The smaller peas, they are much more fresh in flavor and texture, but the bigger piece, they just give a lot of spread on the plate. So the chefs who wants to use big peas, they want a lot of produce on the table. So yeah, some people like them tall, some people like them small. So this is, for example, our lentils. You can see here, they are really nice and fresh. We can grow them under strong light or we can grow them under less strong light. We found that some species work really well under less strong light, and under strong light we need to grow other species. So the way that the light is, that if you are using white light, for example, then the taste of the product is much more sweet. If you are using a violet light, it's a bit more sour. The violet light is more intense, it's more efficient in energy consumption. However, it's not so nice working under violet light. We have a lot of young people working here and we don't want them to use like special LED glasses when they're working in here. We just want a really nice clean work environment that doesn't give you a headache or gives you a bad like sense of seeing, because you get all green in your eyes after working in a violet light for just 10 minutes. So it's really bad for your eyes because of the UV. It's so intense in the violet. The white is a bit more easy to work in. You don't need goggles. You can see here we're using the white light with red spectrum, a little bit of yellow in it, and a small amount of blue. We're using the Paris LEDs, so Paris Europe, we can highly recommend. It's the most efficient LED light for microgreens that we've been working with. We've worked with many, many LED producers like Samsung. We worked with Kind, with Spectrum King, with Fluence as well. And we found that Paris is really, really the best light for herbs, salads, and microgreens. So shout out to Sandro from Netherlands. Thank you for some high quality lighting. We really enjoy working with this, and we are growing really nice product within this light. We're moving a little ahead. So as you can see here, for example, we have some sunflower, nice sunflower growing here. Basically, almost all the shells are falling off by themselves. And we are in this room right now, turning around, I think, with the mushrooms in the back and the aeroponic system over there that I'm gonna show you in a minute. I think we're turning around $20,000 every week right now. So we've expanded a lot since the last video we made, and you can check it out right here if you want to view that. It's really interesting working with all these. It's a live product. It has to be sold within 2 weeks maximum, because if the product gets a little too high, for example, we can see the peas here. They are like reached a point where they are about as high as they can be, because after around 5 days more of growth of this, then it's getting really difficult to store it on cool, because you have a much reduced shelf life in it, and it's not good for business growing the product too much. So you want to grow it as high as this maximum, and then deliver it so you can make a new crop on the same space. Basically, all the space we have here is like around 2 to 3 weeks, and then it gets rotated, so we get new crops all the time. You can see here we have some garlic that's been growing, and it's really fresh. Give it one more week maximum, and then you can't sell it. So you have to all the time make sure that you're doing it in a way that makes the product not bad, but as fresh as possible all the time. This is the aeroponic system that we are operating. This is a system produced by Next Food in Denmark. It's operating only basil and parsley right now. We tested some lemon basil. You can also see that in another video. In the back, we have Hjalmar. He is also one of the partners. Maybe you saw him in another video, but he is watering right now. So in all the microgreens we're growing, we're still watering everything by hand. And some people may think that that's insane, but since we have so much, we are spending like 1.5 hours every day watering, but we just figured that it gives us the best product possible, and we don't want to go on any compromises on the quality. So until we found the right watering solution for the way that we are growing microgreens, we are gonna water it by hand. The aeroponic system that we have here, it's really nice, it's automated. We only put the plugs in, and then 3 weeks later, we have these fully grown basil and parsley herbs. We change the water in the tank, and then we give it fertilizer. We measure the pH value and make sure that the plants have everything they need. The lights is gonna be changed to Paris LED as well. So this system, it uses 2,500 watts. So 2.5 kilowatts per hour. With Paris LED, we're gonna reduce that to around 1,000 or 1,500, so 1.5 kilowatts per hour maximum, I think. Hjalmar, he's watering right now. He's watering all the special herbs that we have. We are growing some shiso, some marigold, some basil, and yeah, basically some really different exotic herbs that you can get on your normal greenhouse. This is Tobias. He is working with us, and he's been working with us here for some time. He is one of the young people as well, helping us with everything we need. And in the back, behind the camera, is Rasmus. He is also one of our young people. He is actually cutting all the videos that we are doing, and he's doing a really good job. We are just trying to make everything work here as efficient as possible with the space that we have. And sometimes it's a challenge, but yeah, we are working very close with the chefs and with the other restaurants and the wholesalers, so we know all the time what people want and what they like. Alex, he is not here at the moment, but he's gonna be part of another future video for sure. He is the director, the CEO of the company, and he's also one of the creators of microgreens here in Denmark. Regarding the watering in the whole production here, we started testing these drippers. So we have a water tank, an irrigation tank in the back, and with connected with a computer and a pump. And then this is watering 2 times per day. Then underneath the trays, we have a big tray to collect the water and make sure that everything is watered from the bottom. And we are just still testing this. We tried testing it on the peas as well, where we had drippers everywhere, and that didn't work out so good. So we also started testing this system here, and it's a sprinkler system, and maybe I can show you how it works. We are also testing this system. This is a sprinkler system. We don't know if it works yet, but we are testing it, so I'm gonna show you how this. So it's basically like just putting the water everywhere and sprinkling the water all over the trays. We don't know if we can make it work so that it like reaches everything and all the trays at once and doesn't water too much in the middle. That's one of our issues right now. So we want to see if we can make it work, and if not, then we are gonna see if we can work with some other kind of way to do the automatic watering. But so far, we are hand watering everything and making sure that the product is the highest quality that it can be, because that's what we want to deliver. We don't want to compromise anything or work with bad products. We believe in what we do, and we believe in that a system like this can be set up so you can grow locally herbs, microgreens, salads, mushrooms, and deliver them to your local restaurant, your local canteen, cafeteria, whatever, and maybe provide more fresh food for the local environment in your area. So as promised, I'm gonna give you a few tips on how you can become a profitable microgreen grower. So the first tip is basically that you should not see this as a way of like making money from day one. It takes a lot of time to get the product right, to get the communication right. But once you have the product right and the communication with the chefs, then it's a really nice business to work in. So the second tip is to just provide great service all the time, provide the best service in your area, make sure that your product is more fresh, much more beautiful looking, because that's going to give you an edge over the competition. And the third lesson I'm going to give you today is that you want to grow this locally. So if no one is growing anything like this in your area locally, then you have an edge, because people want to get more local food and they want to supply and provide with people who want to work with products like this locally when it's grown the closest to the plate as possible. Thank you for watching the video. I hope that you got some knowledge out of it. I hope you got some ideas about how you can start a microgreen business, or like what not to do now. And yeah, basically, if you have any ideas for future videos, let me know in the comment section and something you would like to know. And yeah, subscribe to our channel and give this video a thumbs up to make everyone love microgreens. So have a nice day.
All right. tomorrow, matter of fact, what's tomorrow? Today's Wednesday, so Thursday, Friday. So tomorrow and Friday, we're going to be giving you, if you want to follow along with us or even partner along with us, we're going to tell you what you need to get on your end, all right, if you want to grow microgreens. Now, he's told us how you can start off with one and start off with one room and go up to $20,000 a month. We're keeping it real simple to start. If you follow along with us, because I'll be growing them myself, which I'll be documenting through pictures and videos and live streams, visual live streams where you can actually see me. I'm suggesting that forget about the profit motive, forget about money. If you like microgreens, eating them yourself, because that's what I'm growing. That's my primary motivation, because I want to have fresh greens to eat on a daily, or if not daily, every other day, something like that. That's my first motivation. So, I need to learn, and that's why we'll take tomorrow and Friday, what do you need to organize? Doesn't cost much money. You're not sending us any money. What does it cost to organize, what kind of microgreens do you want to grow, because they're different types. So we'll go through that, where to get your supplies, what to write in your local community. That's, and then we can say, hold it, matter of fact, microgreens are ready to harvest. Usually I'm reading this off online. Microgreens are ready to harvest or harvest usually in 2 to 3 weeks. So that's 14 to 21 days after planting, making them a very quick crop for gardeners. Now, we're not looking to sell our first time at bat on this. We're looking to eat. That's my primary motivation, all right? Because if you're not willing to, use what you grow. Anyway, harvest when you see the first set of real leaves. Once leaves appear, snip the microgreens just above the soil line. Serve immediately for the best flavor. All right, now that's just a little short paragraph, but we know that, all right, within, some people say 10 days. Here's another one. Wait a minute. Now, this is maximizing microgreens harvest to ultimate guarantee. What is it? Generally, microgreens are ready to harvest within 8 to 21 days after sowing, once they reach a true leaf stage. So let's open up this article. This is out of microgreensworld.com. I highly recommend going to this site, which is microgreensworld.com. All right, and they've got quite a bit of information on this site. They have an email list, understanding microgreens growth stages. All right, so you know what? We're going to go over some of this stuff tomorrow. We got a bonus that we'll add in because we're going to be covering this. Now, tomorrow we're going to be talking about pig banking. Not piggy banks, but pig banking. But we're going to include this in that as well, microgreens. And we're going to be going from microgreens world. But to get a jump on tomorrow, go to microgreensworld.com. That's not our site. That's somebody else's. The way I'm approaching it, I'm not looking at it from a monetary standpoint. I'm looking at it, what can I grow that I can personally consume on a regular basis? That means when I go to the grocery store, I don't have to buy microgreens. Because I like spinach, I like lettuce. Now, those are romaine lettuce and kale. I like, but we're starting off with microgreens. That's what we're starting off with, microgreens. That seems to be the easiest way to get into this, at least for me. So that's tomorrow, along with pig banks, not piggy banks, but pig banks. So we'll explain both of those tomorrow with more audio, new audio as well. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day. You know what? And within about 30 days, we might be having for lunch stuff that we've grown. That's a good thought. All right. Talk to you guys later.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking car off business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.